welcome. Sean Delaney here with Inside Education, the podcast for educators who are interested in teaching. You can get in touch with me by writing to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. And you can listen back to hundreds of previous editions of Inside Education on seandelaney.com/podcasts. My guest on the programme this week is someone who wants to see evidence informing education policy and classroom practice. Chris Brown spent time as a policymaker, and today he helps teachers apply research in their practice through the use of professional learning networks. He is the author of 6 books, including Leading the Use of Research and Evidence in Schools. He has won awards for his work from the American Educational Research Association and the University Council for Educational Administration. He is Professor of Education at the University of Portsmouth's School of Education and Sociology. When I met up with Professor Brown at the focal meeting of the World Education Research Association, which was held in Tokyo in August 2019, I noted that Professor Brown was interested in using evidence to influence policy and practice in education. So I began by asking him how well he thinks that's currently happening.
So I started my career as a policymaker. I was head of research for the Training Development Agency for Schools. And at that point, whilst my role was to really kind of synthesize and bring in evidence, it was quite clear that, you know, there was a lot of other things that really impacted on what was happening in terms of how policy was developed. And I think that situation got worse after the election of the kind of 2010 government in terms of policy making. And, you know, ideology started to play a much bigger role. I think in terms of teaching, in England anyway, it's growing apace. I mean, I think there are more and more teachers that are seeing the benefits and taking on the mantle. There are more structural processes in place, you know, research schools, the Chartered College of Teaching, Research Ed, different players that are trying to encourage this. So I think it's growing in size, but I still think there's a lot of work to be done. I think there are a lot of barriers that need to be overcome. I think those barriers are kind of structural, but also policy related, accountability related. I think there are educational barriers. I think there are also motivational barriers. I think teachers don't always recognize the relevance for their work, or they've got actually more pressing day-to-day concerns that needed to be attended to. So I think it's, you know, if I was going to give a score, maybe 6 out of 10, getting there, but could do better.
And if we go into those ones that teachers don't see the value of research, and I think that's probably true, because I think when they have problems to solve, very often their colleagues can solve them best rather than, you know, thinking, well, what does the literature say about this? And there is a validity to that. So to what extent do you think research should be informing teachers' decisions?
Well, I think that's a great point. In terms of should, I believe that we should always be looking for additional insight into how we can do things better. The way I'm going to answer this question, I think, is with kind of recurs to my own work, which is when I work with teachers in research learning networks, what I always do is start by saying, what do we know in this room about this particular problem? What do we know as a school? You know, what do we know is best practice? So if we look at any particular subject, feedback or metacognition or whatever it might be, in a particular room of teachers, in a school of teachers, you have tens, sometimes hundreds years worth of experience. So let's draw on that first of all. And then let's see how the research starts to add to that knowledge, how it challenges that knowledge, how it deepens that knowledge, and how that makes us think more differently about the particular problem, how that makes us think there are other things we might be trying to do. Because the other problem of just relying on research, and I see this with other processes such as, you know, kind of data-informed practice, is that, you know, after a while that kind of level of knowledge stops, as that level of experience stops, or we get trapped in terms of the kind of biases that we have or the groupthink that we have. So I think it's what it's good for is challenging perspectives, giving us new ideas, giving us ways to look at things. And I think, therefore, it's not just the research itself, but it's the process of collaboratively engaging and looking at that research that's really the most productive aspect.
Even I'm thinking of somebody who is leading that workshop, say you have all these teachers and you're somebody leading it, but matters may arise in relation to feedback, or they may arise in relation to classroom management, or it may be in specific subject pedagogical issues. You need somebody there who knows the research. And is that a factor that you've encountered?
Yeah, to my mind, these things always work best in partnership. Now, there's issues of kind of scale in this sense, but really, ideally, you should have schools and universities working together, I think. And I think there's a danger that the camps of kind of research and practice are not coming together as well as they could. I think if you look on Twitter and look at the Twitter debates that are happening, you have a lot of teacher perspective which says, you know, we can go it alone. We don't need to work with researchers. We can do it by ourselves. And I think that's valuable, but I also think it's dangerous. And I think you do need a critical friend. I think you need a critical friend who knows the research, who can translate the research, who can kind of play it back to you and present you with answers in terms of what they think it means and what it's about. So yes, you could do that with an evidence champion in a school, a teacher who's taken that role on board. But in terms of someone who has access, someone who's able to synthesize, someone who's able to kind of work with teachers to facilitate a kind of critical engagement, I really do think you need a partner, probably from a higher education institution.
And I suppose the other side of it then is, do you think that the quality of educational research is robust enough to be able to solve the kind of complex problems that teachers have day to day?
There's a lot of debate about this, and I think that debate originates perhaps from a misunderstanding of the purposes of research often. So when we talk about quality, you know, if we look at, in England we have this thing called the Research Excellence Framework, where we're talking about, you know, is it original, is it significant, does it have robust research methods? Now, the point is, it's not all about doing randomized control trials or doing meta-analyses or meta-syntheses. Sometimes it's about developing new ideas. It's about developing new theories that can then be tested out. And so I think a lot of educational research, although it's based on, often it's based on case studies, often it's based on small scale samples and so on, the point is it's trying to explore, it's trying to develop something new. If we think about Stokes Quadrant, where we talk about the kind of the level of, is it there to develop kind of practical understanding or more blue skies thinking, and we have those different ways of looking at that. Sometimes we have blue skies research, sometimes we have kind of practice inspired research, sometimes we have research that can be used ultimately for practice. All of those things really, really matter. And I think what we need to do is kind of understand that ultimately, yes, hopefully we'll be testing things out and developing stuff that can say, yes, actually this is effective and this isn't effective. But we also need to understand what's the purpose of education, to be challenging kind of our ideas about education. Otherwise, you know, if we didn't even think about those things, we could be trapped in this kind of high autonomy, high accountability, just trying to develop research that will help teachers do better in that particular framework. But should we also be doing research that challenges that whole framework and thinks about, you know, other kind of epochs and other things that we could be looking at? So I guess, coming back to your question, I think there is lots of robust research, but I think there is other research that other sciences do as well that starts to think about the theories that we might want to introduce and we might want to test. And I think it's kind of understanding that that's also a valid purpose of research. And as long as that's done well, which I think it is on many occasions, that's absolutely, absolutely fine.
Or another way of getting at this might be to ask, where do you set the bar in terms of, you know, will you encourage teachers to be informed by this piece of research, or will you say, no, look, this just does not, you know, meet the kind of rigorous standards I would expect from a research study?
Well, I think this goes back to two things. One, what do we see the purpose of research being in informing teachers? And two, understanding that there's the kind of real plurality in types of different educational research. So yes, we have quantitative research, we have qualitative research, we have different standards for how you measure the quality of those. So, you know, we would judge quantitative and qualitative research in different ways. So I think as long as those pieces of research met the thresholds that we'd have for that particular type of research, then I would encourage teachers to look at it. Clearly, there can be bad aspects of research in both senses. But if we think about also how we want teachers to engage with research, I think then we need to think about, you know, what does that look like? So if we look at Carol Weiss's work, and she talks about this notion of instrumental research use, conceptual research use, and symbolic research use. With instrumental research use, the research kind of gets acted upon as it stands. So it's almost that it's evidence-based. You know, here's a piece of research, this says we should do feedback in a particular way, you go and implement that with fidelity. Conceptual research use is more about how it inspires the thinking of the person using the research, how it kind of adds to their current understanding. So instead of saying, okay, here's the research and it says go and act in a particular way, it says, how does this help you think differently about the particular problem? How does this help you think about new ways of doing things? Symbolic research we can ignore for the moment because it's about, you know, using the research to justify a particular course of action. Now, I think if we look at how teachers act, this idea of instrumental research use is completely unfeasible, because there is no teacher in the land that will take something and act on it with fidelity, because they'll take into account the context that they're in, the particular response they have to give to a student. So it's unlikely to take place in that way. So what we need to do then is think about how we can use theories of action to help teachers take research and develop new ways of working based on it. So a theory of action would be the particular outcome that we'd expect from different courses of action. So we have a problem, we have an understanding of why that problem is. We then develop a way of tackling that problem based on what we know, based on what the research says. We try and work out how we're going to bring that particular solution to life. We work about how we might expect change to look like, how that happens, what the outcomes might be, and we track that process through. But it provides a logical way of thinking about the change you want to achieve and how you're going to bring that change to life. And for me, that's more important than a piece of research that we would expect to see teachers implement with fidelity, because what it gives teachers is that autonomy to say, there's a problem in my school, I've got some ideas about how I want to do it, I've thought about those solutions logically, I thought about how I'm going to implement those solutions logically, I've got an understanding for how I might correct kind of faults or flaws if those things aren't panning out as to how I want them to be. And so you then get to test things out. You get to see if your theory of action is correct. You get to modify it if it's not, or you get to try something different if you've embarked on the wrong path. Alternatively, if your theory of action is right, you then get to share it with other colleagues who can implement it in their classroom. And I think for me, that's much more powerful.
So what I think you're saying then is that the published research may be a starting point from which a teacher will develop a theory of action, but it's not that they're necessarily going to be trying to replicate what was published in a published study.
Yeah, exactly so. So if you've got a study that took place in America with a completely different context, you can see how you can recontextualize that to your own setting. You can see how you can make that evidence come to life where you are. I think a really good example of this is, in Tennessee, in the States, they had a class reduction program, with the idea being that, you know, if you have smaller class sizes, you've got more adult-student interaction, you get a reduction in poor behavior, you get more attention in terms of dealing with particular problems students have. And that was effective, that worked. So they tried to roll it out in California, but it didn't work in California. And the reason it didn't work in California was that they didn't have enough qualified teachers to be able to bring that approach to life. So just thinking about that as an example, what you could do if you were a teacher in England, say, is say, okay, well, this approach in Tennessee, the reason they reduced the classes was because of this, or class size was because of this. All right, in my school, the way I'm going to improve kind of adult student interaction, the way I'm going to reduce this kind of behavior that's happening, or the way I'm going to get more attention paid to students is X, Y, and Z. And hopefully, as a theory of action approach, that's going to achieve the same outcomes as what happened in Tennessee, because I've tapped into the same kind of social drivers that led to that positive change.
One barrier that teachers may encounter in trying to apply research in their work is the fact that so much published research is behind a metaphorical firewall. They don't have access to it. How do you overcome that in your work?
Just generally, before we get to my work, I mean, just generally, there are now steps to try and overcome that. So in England, the Chartered College of Teachers, if you're a member, gives you access to journal articles. You've also got kind of meta-syntheses and meta-analyses that are available. So the Education Endowment Foundation Toolkit, for example, provides meta-syntheses that teachers can access without having to get behind a paywall. I think in my own personal work, when I'm working with teachers, what I try to do in any case is to give them kind of summaries of research that brings together good quality studies and kind of produces them in kind of 5 or 6 pages. So it kind of provides an entry level to the research I want them to engage with. I try and provide it in a language that's accessible. I provide it in a format that they can easily get to understand, you know, how the research was conducted, what it suggests, what the implications are, questions for them to think about. Then I start to kind of introduce them to research studies that are, you know, kind of journal articles and so on, which I download and print for them. I do think also there's more open access research that's available. And again, I try and signpost teachers to that research. So many universities now will have a database, a pure database or similar, that where researchers have kind of uploaded their studies before they've been published and people can access those. So I think, you know, I try to encourage those whilst I provide them with sources themselves, I try to encourage teachers to use those sites that the stuff is freely available.
And the synthesis that you create, are they just for the teachers you work with, or do you publish them yourself?
Generally, they're just for the teachers I work with. But I mean, you know, that's a good point. Could easily put them on a website and make them available for people.
And have you seen any good examples yourself of teachers using research to change their practice?
At the moment, I'm at the University of Portsmouth, and I work with a lot of schools in the New Forest area. And as well as working with them, you know, I work with the teachers, develop case studies to see how this is changing their practice, to get them to reflect on what's happening. And there's been some excellent examples there of, for example, one school I worked with was looking at summer-born children. So I was looking at the children that are born between April and August and are essentially, you know, a year behind their peers. And looking at how they needed to change their approach and their teaching and their engagement with parents in relation to those children to kind of change what they do. And we, you know, went through this process of engaging with research, developing new approaches, trying those out, seeing how impactful they were. And in terms of, you know, achievement against early years goals, for example, the scores rocketed up. It was absolutely incredible. It was really great. Another time, and I worked with, I got some funding from the Education Endowment Foundation to work with, it was 110 schools. We split them into two groups of 55 control, 55 intervention. And of those 55, they were then split into smaller groups of five or six schools. And we went through this two-year cycle of engaging in them with research. And certainly the groups I was working with, it was great to see the kind of change in confidence. It was great to see the change in knowledge, the way they talked about and engaged with research. And there was an evaluation of that approach undertaken by University of Bristol. Now, what was interesting was that although it was a randomized control trial, and it couldn't say this particular approach was more effective in improving student outcomes per se, because in part the control group also wanted to engage with research, which is why they signed up to the program. But what it did show was that actually teachers generally engaging with research in a collaborative way seemed to be very positive. It seemed to be positive in terms of teachers improving their practice, but also in terms of key stage two results. And I thought that was really, really encouraging. So we're seeing it, you know, we are seeing it over time.
And one of the ways that you work is with these networks of teachers. Can you say a little bit about how that operates?
Yeah. So, I mean, the kind of premise behind it is that we have a self-improving school system in England. That kind of approach is growing elsewhere as well. And, you know, it's clear that not every teacher can engage with every other teacher in every other school. So what we try and do is we select one or two teachers from schools. We work with groups of five schools, and we take those teachers through a four-stage cycle of inquiry. So in the first stage, we look at, you know, what they're trying to achieve, what's their vision. If they're looking at, you know, English as an additional language, or if they're looking at, you know, including the inclusion of special educational needs children in mainstream schools, you know, what do they want to achieve by the end of the cycle? What will be different for those children that they're not seeing now? Then we get them to look at their own understanding. You know, what do they know is effective practice in for them personally, for their school, and in the group that they're working with. Then we introduce the research evidence in relation to the topic they're interested in, and we ask them to think about how this challenges and how this deepens their understanding. Then we get them to go away and collect data on the here and now picture, because whilst they have a particular perspective that they're trying to explore, we want to make sure that's grounded in kind of data or reality. You know, is that really the picture they want to look at? We also get them to ask their colleagues for their opinions and their advice. They come back, we get them to look at the data and to say, okay, based on this situation that you found yourself in, based on the research we engaged with in the last session, what are you now going to do to try and improve that situation? And we take them through a theory of action approach, as I mentioned before. They develop an approach, they develop a new way of working that we want them to try out. Then we introduce them to effective ways to trial new approaches to teaching and learning. So, if, for example, joint practice development, lesson study, observation, so on and so forth. We get them to think of a way they're going to work with some colleagues in their school to try something out and how they're going to collect data to see whether it was effective. Then they come back for the third workshop, and the third workshop is a little bit different because, to my mind, if you want to achieve something different in the school, you've got to know about effective change management. You've got to be able to understand how to convince your colleagues to take on board new ways of working, how to actually make sure that you are going to overcome some of the key barriers that exist within your school. So first of all, we looked at whether there was any change from this from the second workshop, and whether they are on the right path and whether they want to take that forward. Then we introduce them to this notion of change management, and we get them to think about a change management strategy that they're going to introduce into their school, and how they're going to do it, and who they're going to involve, and what are the key kind of players and stakeholders they need to have on board, and how they're going to do that. And then we think about how they're going to operationalize that. But also vitally, we get them to think about impact data and what that might look like and how to collect it. So if they are successful in achieving change in their school, what will that look like, and how are they going to collect data to see whether that's worked? And then the fourth workshop, we look at whether that's been different. You know, has that impact data shown that there's a change? And if not, what are they going to do differently? And if it is different, how are they going to share that with colleagues within their school, but within their partner school, so that everyone benefits? So we look at effective knowledge mobilization. And then what I do in that process in the second year is take them through something similar. So they're going through that cycle again, but I try and build their capacity, because in a sense, I don't want to be doing this. I want teachers to be able to do this by themselves where possible. I do think there needs to be critical friends, but if we can build capacity, then my role can be kind of reduced and limited, and we can get teachers working together. So I get them to, you know, go and source literature. I give them freely accessible, you know, websites with freely accessible literature. I get them to go and do that over the summer. I get them to develop their own syntheses. I get them to think about how that they can input and lead those workshops in year two. And then we see what difference that's made.
And about how many workshops then would teachers attend in their cycle?
It's four in each year. So the workshop one is all about, you know, vision and engaging with research. Workshop two is about trialing. Three is about change management, and four is about impact. And so that'll happen, you know, for example, October, December, March and June or July. Over a given cycle.
And it's the same teachers the following year, or would it be different teachers the second year?
Normally it's the same teachers, and ideally it would be the same teachers, because we want to draw on what they learned in the first year, understand how to do it themselves in the second year. But it's interesting, you know, that you do get turnover, and that's one of the real life problems, I think, of kind of research informed practice.
And how long would each workshop be?
They're normally whole day workshops, but it's interesting that different people I've worked with, you know, try and get me to try out different things. So, you know, can we use half days? Does that work? Can we use a more technological approach? You know, that's where I'm kind of just giving some input, I guess, in a blended learning type of way, that and teachers are going to do stuff. But for me, the best approach is giving teachers that time and that space just to think, and a whole day out really works.
So somebody puts a substitute teacher in for them for the
exactly.
day?
So the cost to the school, because I think one of the issues with research-informed teaching is that there are a variety of costs for schools. There's time costs, because you've got to free up teachers' time, not only to attend a workshop, which would be the price of a substitute teacher, but also when they come back, giving them the time to think about things, to trial things out, to work with their colleagues and so on. So, yeah, that would be one of the kind of costs.
And they would be coming from different schools?
Yes. I mean, the idea is that you create these local networks of schools. Now, from my work with colleagues on kind of professional learning networks, you know, we know that geography matters for a number of different reasons. Ideally, you want schools to be able to kind of come together and travel together. And it's nice if we can kind of vary the location so that everybody gets to see each other's, these other schools. But also, in a kind of close geographical context, you've got a shared history, you know, a shared community understanding. You know, often there'll be, all these schools will be facing similar issues, and it's nice to be able to get them to kind of realize that they're not alone in tackling those issues, that there is commonality, and also that they'll have different ways of dealing with particular problems.
And do you give a template to the teachers for what they will do when they go back to their own school, or what kind of expectations do you have for them when they leave your network and go back to their local school, to their own school?
Yeah, I do. I give them templates, and I also give them, not instructions per se, but I give them kind of homework tasks that I need them to achieve. And I think that's a really interesting point, because, you know, you want to build capacity, you want to build the skills of teachers, you want to build their ability to lead. But at the same time, teachers also like a template, and they also like to have something clear to guide them. So I try and marry those two tensions of me not wanting to limit what teachers are able to do, but get them to kind of act in a way that they see appropriate, but also that does what needs to be done as part of the homework.
And in one of your presentations here that I've just attended, you talked about in-degree centrality, which is kind of trying to identify the influencer teachers, if you like. Can you say a little bit about how important that is, and how that feeds into your model?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big part of what I do. So what I'm interested in really is looking at the notion of leadership, because leadership is key to achieving change in the school. And naturally, you have formal leaders. So you have the, you know, the head teacher or the deputy head teachers or the assistant heads or heads of subject or so on. And those leaders can achieve change in some key ways. So they can achieve change as transformational leaders by setting the vision for the school, by setting the cultural expectations of the school, by freeing up resource to enable teachers to behave in a particular way, so, you know, creating the time and the space. They can also, formal leaders can also act as instructional leaders. Now, they can do that themselves by kind of modeling what needs to be done, by living, you know, by walking the talk. So if you're saying, okay, I want to have a culture of innovation, you know, if school leaders are then modeling that culture of innovation by, you know, asking questions of their own practice, by saying, you know what, I don't know, this is how I'm going to find the answer out, by working with their colleagues, you know, in kind of lesson study trios or whatever else, that models what needs to be done. Of course, in bigger schools, you know, school leaders themselves might not have all the knowledge needed to do that, and that's one of the kind of the challenges of leadership. So you might want to do that in a distributed leadership way, so you might want to empower others. But nonetheless, that's kind of in the gift of the formal school leader. But we also know that, you know, leadership is influence, and influence doesn't necessarily happen in a hierarchical way. And if we think about the kind of connections between teachers as social networks, so not necessarily hierarchical diagrams, but the networks that exist when teachers reach out to others or create friendship or bonds or ties with others, then it's really interesting to see where power lays, because the power then lays in terms of the connectivity that occurs. So if you've got teachers that are highly connected to others who kind of reach out to them for advice and support, then you have people who are kind of informal leaders and people who can offer advice and support or who can influence the perspectives of many other people. And we know from various studies that form of informal leadership, so the work of Jim Spallan, Alan Daly and so on in the States, that the work of the informal leader is kind of instrumental in making change happen or not, or blocking change. So what we try and do with these networks is we try and get a senior leader on board, ideally the head teacher, but if not someone else who can come to the workshops to understand from a perspective of how we need kind of formal decisions to be made in the school. But the informal leader is key because they can galvanize support in the classroom, because they can say to other people, hey, we've been doing this and this is great. They can lead kind of similar processes back in their own school because they're trusted and they're relied upon for advice and support. So actually, we think together the informal and the formal leader are key to making kind of change happen.
One of the things you talk about in your work is the idea of best practice. What criteria do you use to evaluate what is best practice?
I think that's a great example. For me, best practice is kind of achieving the goals you've set yourself successfully in relation to the values that you have, in relation to the context that kind of govern your school, and in relation to the resources you have available to you. So, you know, we have this notion of kind of research best practice, and often that is kind of determined by, you know, effect size. Often it's about, we've synthesized all the research on what works, and we know that this is effective. Now, I think that's one way of thinking about things, but clearly there are different ways of achieving particular goals. You know, I used to work in criminal justice, and what was really interesting was the difference between the criminal justice policies of the new Labour government, which was locking people up essentially on lots of short-term sentencing, and the government that came in after them, which was about, okay, can we think about restorative justice? The idea being the same thing, we're trying to reduce crime, but there are different values that are underpinning that. So you've got to think about, what do we want as a school? What are we trying to achieve as a school? You know, and what do our values say kind of govern that process? What's the context here? You know, where are the kids coming from? You know, what are their backgrounds? What's the kind of wider ecology of the school that we're situated in, on the wider area? And therefore, it's trying to say, okay, what do we want for these kids? How are we going to do it? And what does success look like? And when you've achieved something that gets those, that meets those, or ticks those boxes, that's for me is best practice. So in many ways, it's kind of localized and it's contextually specific.
So you're not so much looking then at scaling it up as encouraging schools at local level to decide what is best for them.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. This kind of notion of scale up for me is really interesting because, you know, you hear people talking about scale up as being acting with fidelity. So, you know, it's kind of everybody's doing a particular schema in a particular way. For me, the scale up is achieving the results you need to achieve by tapping into, you know, what's there and the kind of social drivers for action. So no, ideally what I would see was people learning from others and taking that on board and making that work for them in their situation to achieve the results that they want.
Are there areas of research that you have found, like, yes, there is so much evidence here to support decisions, and on the opposite, are there areas where you found we really don't have enough research in this area to inform what we want to know about?
That's interesting, but I also think it's interesting about ultimately how things, without a kind of understanding of a theory of action, become, you know, kind of bastardized. So you've got, for example, Carol Dweck's work on growth mindsets, which, you know, has a good evidence base. And you can see when teachers do it well and when they understand the purpose behind it, you know, really can make a difference. But I was at a school FATE a few weeks ago, and I was kind of listening to these kids talking, and this kid, they were kind of having, you know, kind of engaging in some banter, and one kid said, well, yeah, he's taller than you, but the other kid's growth mindset's much bigger, so he's better. And you were kind of thinking, now it's got to this stage, it's kind of lost meaning, you know, it's just become a catchphrase and a kind of term. And actually, if you forget about what's the purpose and the point, you know, any piece of, you know, what started off being as effective becomes, you know, it just becomes meaningless. So I would say there are certain things that are, you know, absolutely effective if they're done in the right way. So, you know, metacognition, effective feedback, I would include in that growth mindsets as well. In terms of stuff that isn't effective, you know, we have to question the role of homework, for example, in schools, you know, but this might go back to the point of what kind of homework and why are we doing it. So, but in terms of those powerful things, yeah, metacognition, feedback.
How did you become interested in the whole area of evidence-informed practice in education?
I think, I mean, so for me, it started off because I was working in policy and I was trying to understand why, when I was being paid to do a job that was to bring together evidence and present it to policymakers for them to use, it kind of invariably wasn't being used. And I thought, okay, you know, you look to yourself first and think, maybe I'm just not communicating it effectively. And you kind of ask, and is it, you know, could I do something better? And they say, yeah, you know, it is, I just don't understand it. So you work on communication and you try and make it simple and kind of, anyway, you go around these cycles and cycles and you realize after a while that isn't the answer. And I was doing a master's degree at the time. And so I made that the kind of subject of my thesis and tried to understand a bit more about this. And then it became the subject of my PhD. And it's just interesting. It was interesting for me to look at the different factors, you know, the kind of ideological factors. If something doesn't fit within the government of the day's remit, they're going to ignore it, no matter how, you know, kind of effective compelling. Something, yeah, or compelling it's proven to be. Who the researcher is and their position in relation to the government, you know, really matters. You know, if you're a trusted source of advice, you're going to get taken in and people are going to listen to you. So there's all these different factors that matter. At the time, I was enjoying doing a PhD. And when I finished, I thought, actually, for me, this is more exciting than working in government. So I want to become an academic. So I kind of took a leap of faith and I left policy to join academia. And I was lucky enough to get a postdoctoral fellowship at the Institute of Education in London. And there I met a colleague, Professor Louise Stoll, and she went, Chris, actually, if you want to change education, is just stay away from policy because it's never going to work. So start to work in schools because that's where the action is. And so together we started to think about how we could work with teachers and with schools to change what they did. And we, you know, we worked on various projects, you know, ESRC funded projects, EEF funded projects. But in terms of your question, I was interested in trying how to make things better. I mean, my bachelor's was an economics degree, and I remember at the time, and I was 16, kind of choosing economics, reading a copy of The Economist, and it was like, be a government economist, you know, you can make all these different changes. I thought, that sounds fantastic, making a change, that's what I want to do. And I think my interest in evidence-informed policy and practice stems from that. You know, how can we improve things? How can we make things better? How can we bring on board new evidence that will help teachers and help policymakers do stuff that they do even more effectively? So I think it's that kind of, it's probably a very rational approach, I think.
And was your policy work, was that as a civil servant or was it with a political party?
No, it was with a civil servant. So I used to work for the Training Development Agency for schools, and the kind of remit was to get the best people into teaching, develop them effectively as teachers, and to also work out how you can bring other people in, so teaching assistants, and use those effectively in schools.
We might have covered this already, but what are professional learning networks?
I started off being interested in evidence use and then started to work with professional learning networks without realizing I was working in professional learning networks. And actually the category of professional learning networks is kind of extends beyond research use. And it's about bringing together people from different communities of practice to work collaboratively to try and improve what they do. So it's still situated in this notion of kind of school collaboration, wider self-improvement, by bringing together people from different schools or different communities of practice within those schools, other colleagues who might be interested, so, you know, academic researchers, people from other parts of the ecology that surround the child, so, you know, police or social services and so on, to work out how we can tackle particular problems, to take back those solutions, and to help all teachers within a school kind of use those effectively.
One of the things that you said in your presentation was that how well research-informed practice occurs depends on things like encouragement, social influence, trust, and innovation. I wonder, could you just say a little bit about those and how those can encourage or disincentivize research-based informed practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. When we're trying to get teachers within a school or across schools to use research, there's a whole range of different factors that are going to affect that. Starting with social influence, I think social influence is vital. Now, there are different ways of thinking about this. But if we think about researchers as consumers of research, we can think about, you know, actually as a consumer, you're going to be concerned with probably three things: the benefits you're going to get from consuming something, the costs of consuming something, but also what signals are there from consuming it? What does it signify to others that you're consuming something? And that's really where social influence has a big role to play, because, you know, we're constantly being influenced by other people. We exist within networks, within societies. There are norms, there are barriers. We understand those, but we take our cues from other people. So if we're in a school and people are engaging in a particular way, we know that to fit in, we have to behave in that way also. So that kind of notion that if our colleagues are doing something, it's more likely to make us do something. And therefore, if our colleagues are using research, we're more likely to use research. But also, if our colleagues are using research, we'll also find ways to overcome the kind of costs we associate with using research. You know, if it confuses us, we can ask people, we can reach out and get them to help us. But we'll also see the benefits of doing so, because we'll see that they're doing it for a particular reason. Leadership matters, as I said before, and, you know, leaders have a big role to play. You know, we're not going to have systemic use of research or even school level use of research if school leaders aren't encouraging it, and also if they're not facilitating it, if they're not creating the right conditions within the school to help us engage with the research by creating the space, by creating access to the research that we need, by helping us, by sending us, for example, to do master's degrees or you know, anything else that's associated with the research use. So leadership is important, linked to leadership, but it also important in its own right is the kind of the climate that exists within a school. So, you know, are you working in a trusting environment? Do you feel able to say I don't know, or to reach out for help, or do you feel able to offer help? Because actually, you know, trust works both ways. You know, you're not going to offer help if you think that help's going to be rejected or ridiculed. And linked to that, do you feel then able to try something new, try something different, engage in kind of reasonable levels of risk taking to try and improve outcomes for your children? All of these things take place in an environment of trust. Likewise, you know, are you encouraged to innovate? You know, is this a school or an environment in which you are encouraged to try and continually get better? And if you are, then it's more likely that, as well as kind of looking at what your colleagues doing and looking at what colleagues in other schools doing, that you'll look at what research says is effective. You know, other kind of factors that are kind of situated around that are, you know, can you access research, and are you able to do the things you need to do? Can you understand it? But to my mind, those things are really, really important to create a situation within a school that teachers feel that they want to, that they're able, and they're supported to engage with research evidence.
One of the things you mentioned, Chris, in your presentation was the idea of edumyths, and you know, that how we can all fall for certain ideas like Brain Gym. And I'm thinking as well of a guest who was on this program before, David Dido, and how everything you know about education is wrong. How can teachers, you know, avoid falling into these kind of traps, or, you know, going down these rabbit holes that have dead ends?
Yeah, I think the problem is that the solution is also often used by teachers to kind of block trying something different. But, you know, we can always question what's underlying this new practice. I think, you know, if we're presented with something new, we should say, okay, why does it work? What is the theory of action behind it? Why is it supposed to achieve change? what is the evidence of success? You know, how has it been shown to have impact? Now, like I said, you know, that can also be used by people to say, well, I'm not going to do anything different unless I know that. And we should also, you know, trial things out to see if it has evidence of impact and to test things out. So we should question, if we think it's reasonable, we should then see, okay, I'm going to test this out. This is my baseline position. What difference would I expect to see? Can I measure data on that? Can I see if that's happening? And just be, I guess it's critical consumers, right? You know, that's the important thing. Don't be naive, but don't be over cynical at the same time, you know? So try an experiment, but just make sure that you're experimenting in a way that you can see whether that's actually made a difference.
Don't go on autopilot, you're
exactly.
saying.
Yeah.
We're coming near the end, Chris, and it's just a few general questions I'd like to ask you. The first one is, what are schools for, or what is school for?
You know, your immediate response is to let parents go to work. They need somewhere to keep their kids, don't they? While they go and do something busy. I think it's if you look at, you know, the work of Biesta and so on, then schools are there to impart knowledge, but they're also there to impart kind of values of society and to help children understand the role that they need to play in society and how they can do that effectively. I think if we go back to Plato, for example, when you kind of had a nascent democracy in Greece, then the role of education was to make sure that decisions are taken not on whim, but on kind of on reasoned argument. And I think that's quite important. I think if you look at the German tradition, you have it's not just about achieving knowledge and success, but it's about becoming an effective citizen. It's about being someone who can grow as a person. This notion of buildings is about being able to grow as a person, being able to function in society effectively. So I think, you know, if you bring those things together, it's about imparting the knowledge we need children to know. And I think that's important for kind of societal unity, you know, this notion of symbols in society and responding to those symbols in particular ways. Having the knowledge you need to be able to do that, to engage with society effectively, and understanding how to be a responsible citizen within society.
Is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
Yeah, there are a few, but the biggest one is probably the school system I went to in the south of England had kind of first schools and middle schools, and the middle school I went to, Townhill Middle School, their head teacher there, Charlie Cuff, he really kind of helped me think and challenge my thinking and continually challenge my thinking all the time. So he would set me challenges and problems just to help me think, and I'd go home and I'd think about these challenges and problems for ages, and that kind of meant that mentality is kept with me, and that's, you know, what I like to do. So I've been walking the streets here in Tokyo and I like just to think about new ideas and challenges and continually kind of test those ideas out in my head. So I think that's thanks to him.
And did he just do that to you, or did he do that for everyone?
I think he probably did that for everybody. And I mean, you know, at the time when you're kind of 10, you kind of just take that in personally and kind of digest it, and you're thinking about what he said and how to do it. He had a very, you know, a personal perspective. So he would give me personal challenges to think about, but he may well have done that to everybody in the class. So
who or what inspires you?
I think it's the what. It's great thinking inspires me. I remember when I started doing my master's degree and my PhD, kind of reading about new ideas or listening to new ideas and just thinking, that's brilliant. That helps me see the world in a different way. So anybody who's able to inspire me with new ideas and great work, that's where that comes from.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
My favourite writers aren't writing about education necessarily, but their work is applicable to education. So I like the French sociologist Jean Baudrillard, who works about simulacra, you know, kind of representation, reality, what is it, writes about what consumerism is and that kind of thing. I like Stephen Ball's work, who is about education, but again, thinking critically about digging deeper under the kind of surface level, you know, what people are saying, what does that really mean, what is that rooted in? So again, people who help me challenge what's going on.
And finally, what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
I've done some great courses. And one of the courses I did was my kind of postgraduate certificate in teaching and learning in higher education. And that really helped me understand how to really think about kind of conveying ideas in different ways in order to help people understand really what you're talking about and to kind of, you know, understand with what are you trying to, where are you trying to get them to at the end of the session you're teaching them in, and how are you going to do that? How are you going to convey that knowledge? How are you going to work with them to explain something, to work it through with themselves, to think about how they can think about what you've taught them?
And that was Chris Brown from the University of Portsmouth speaking to me in Tokyo back in August 2019.
Next we go to this week's R. That's where I select an R from either a rant, a review, a recommendation, a response to a listener's question, a rewind of a previous episode, or a report from research. And this week I'm bringing you a report from research on the topic of homework.
When I wrote my book about primary teaching, in one chapter I wrote that it is difficult to find any concrete benefits of homework. And I based this claim on research that I had studied in many different areas, which found that really there were very few benefits of homework, especially for primary school children. That changed a little bit in secondary school, but for primary school children, there was very little evidence of benefits for homework. Now, I've often been asked, since I wrote the book, if things had changed or if I had changed my views on it. And largely I haven't, but I do want to bring you some information about a research study that was published in 2017 on the topic of students' achievement in maths and science according to their homework. And I suppose I should say before going into that study, it's very difficult to conduct research on homework. It's a little bit like conducting research on schoolwork or electricity or reading and books. Are these things good or are they bad? Well, schoolwork, it depends. It depends what happens during the day in school. Or electricity, it depends on how you use it. Of course, electricity can be used for good, but it can also lead to problems in terms of danger or in terms of environmental problems. Reading and books. Well, is reading good? Of course, reading is potentially good, but it does depend on the books that you read. For homework, what makes conducting research on homework difficult is, first of all, what constitutes homework? And how long do children spend on homework? Do you go by what the children say? Do you go by what the teacher recommends? Or do you go by what the parents say? Because all of these can give you very different insights into the amount of time that children spend on homework, and specifically how long they spend actually working on homework. And another factor that makes a difference is how often homework is given. It's also important to think about what the opportunity cost of homework is. If children are spending their time doing homework, well then what are they not doing? So perhaps they're not playing sports, or they're not outdoors playing with their friends or indoors playing with their friends. Or maybe if they're doing homework, that's taking time from watching TV and engaging with social media. So it's the alternatives to homework that also have to be considered. Very often, homework research doesn't look into particular subjects. It looks at homework in general and its effect in general, and that can make a difference. And then how do you measure the effect of homework? Is it about how well children do on tests afterwards, or is it their attitude towards working? This is all important. So the particular study I want to talk to you about today is what's called a meta-analysis. And that's where researchers look at a number of studies over several years and try and see what lessons are coming out of those studies. And these particular authors that published their article in 2017, Fan and colleagues, they looked at research between 1986 and 2015 on homework. And what they found was that there was a small and positive relationship between homework and student achievement in maths and science. And that might seem to be out of sync with what I wrote in my book. And there's a few things that need to be taken into account there. First of all, this is just one study. Secondly, the benefits of homework were found to be small. Although they were positive, they were also small. Another factor is that this study looked specifically at two subjects, maths and science. Now, they do note that they had very few articles in primary school science, but they did have some in maths. Another way that this study differed to previous studies is that the benefits of homework were stronger in high school and in elementary school. And when we're talking about elementary school in the American context, we're really talking up to about fifth class. And that was also unusual because benefits of homework in previous studies had been associated with high school rather, and maybe middle school, but not so much elementary school or primary school. However, there are some lessons that can be taken from this. First of all, what seems to be important in terms of the positive benefits of homework seems to relate to completing the homework. So it's not so much just to do it, but it's actually completing it. It's the amount of effort that's put into it, and it's the grade that's given to it. These seem to matter more than how often homework is given and how long is spent on it. And if you think of that in relation to how most schools measure homework, it's largely in terms of the time spent on it. But it would be better, perhaps, to think about the effort that children put into their homework, whether or not they complete it, and the grade that they get for it. That would seem to make a difference in terms of the benefits of homework. This article also noted that there may be a cultural component to these findings, that homework seemed to be of most benefit to students who were studied in the United States rather than students who were studied in Asia. And we do know that a lot of students in Asian countries frequently attend after-school classes or after-school cram schools in order to help their progress in schools. So that's why homework may be less beneficial there. So in terms of the lessons that we might take from this research, I suppose the first one is that, yes, there may be small benefits for giving homework to students in mathematics. The second is to look for quality, in other words, completion and effort in homework rather than the quantity of the homework. You can read more about homework and my thoughts on this topic in Chapter 5 of my book, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have. And Chapter 5 is called Reinforcing Teaching at Home.
And you can find a link to the article on homework on the programme's show notes. You'll also find notes there for my interview with Chris Brown. If you liked this week's podcast, it'd be great if you could leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you've already done that, then please tell someone else who is interested in teaching about the programme. To listen back to this programme or any of the hundreds of previous episodes, please go to seandelaney.com and click on the Podcasts tab. To get in touch with the programme, write to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. Until next Wednesday, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.